Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather round the radio. It's time for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show with lots of good people involved. And the host of the show is Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she is indeed a champion in the battle against ageism. Let's kick this hour off right now with Carol Marks in conversation with Dr. Norman Doidge. He's a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and a New York Times bestselling author of a book titled The Brain That Changes Itself. He's going to talk to Carol now about his new book titled The Brain's Way of Healing, Remarkable Discoveries and Recoveries from the Frontiers of Neuroplasticity. It's published by Viking.
In your books, you say the brain is plastic. So what does that term mean, and why did it take centuries for this discovery to take place?
That's a very good question. So plastic or neuroplastic means that the neurons, the cells of the brain that conduct electrical signals, are modifiable, adaptable, changeable, and that they can form and reform circuitry, the circuitry that processes thinking, feeling, perceiving, moving, and so on. And it had been thought for the longest time. There are other levels of plasticity as well. The brain can change its structure at a number of levels. It can turn certain genes on and off. It can make different proteins all the time. It can change the number of connections between brain cells. And large groups of brain cells can form different kinds of circuits and change. Now, why, if the brain is plastic, you ask, did we not know it? There are a number of reasons for that. Some of them are practically philosophical, and others are very technical. At a philosophical level, since the rise of modern science, there's been a strong tendency to conceive of the brain as a machine with parts, and each part is thought to perform a single mental function in a single location in the brain. That's how most neuroscientists describe the brain. And as the machine metaphors, as the machines around us changed, the kind of machine we described, the brain would change. At a certain point, it was very much like almost like a pumping system early on. And there was a hydraulic metaphor for the brain. When we discovered electrical circuitry, people started talking about brain circuits as being hardwired, an electrical metaphor. The most current metaphor, of course, is that the brain is an advanced electrical machine. It's a computer, and people speak of the brain as having hardware. And, of course, the only change that hardware undergoes is it degenerates with time. So this machine metaphor has been very, very powerful. I mean, if you asked a neuroscientist, is the brain a machine? Some of them would say, well, not quite. It's a metaphor. But, unfortunately, our metaphors have a tendency to take over. And so people would talk about brain mechanisms using machine terminology, and talked about the whole notion that everything is predetermined in the brain, the way and is fixed, the way things are predetermined in machines, if you will. Machines are designed for particular purposes. But there are other reasons why we missed it. One of them has to do with the very poor prognosis of many brain conditions. And the other thing is sometimes people would mistake rigid behaviors in their partners, their friends, their siblings, to mean that their brains were rigid. But actually, you can get rigid behaviors if you have a plastic brain. For instance, I like to think, and this is a metaphor, that plasticity is very much like snow on a hill in winter. If you go down that hill the very first time, it's a virgin hill. Because the snow is plastic and pliable, you can take many paths down that hill. But if you had a very good run down that hill, you'll be inclined to use the same run, the same path the next time, and you'll build tracks in the snow, and they become ruts. So this is a metaphor for how if we do something over and over, because the brain is plastic, those circuits get very fast and efficient at doing what they do, and it's sometimes hard to get out of them.
Absolutely. And, you know, the book talks all about the ways that we can retrain our nerve cells to do things that we, because of disease or an injury, haven't been able to do. And I thought it was just fascinating that your book talks about a lot of degenerative diseases, which includes Alzheimer's, and it talks about the fact that Alzheimer's, along with Parkinson's and Huntington's disease, it's possible through retraining the brain to be able to have better movement and to walk better.
Well, we have to break them all down. With Alzheimer's, I don't talk about any kind of cure. What I talk about is a very, very important study that was the 12th study of Alzheimer's exercise and healthy activities. But this 12th study solved some problems in the previous 11. And it's a study that was done by an extremely important group in Wales, related to the Cochrane Institute, which is generally considered the gold standard in assessing studies in medicine. And this study, led by Peter Elwood, studied about just over 2,300 men in a town over 30 years. So this is a very substantial study by a group with a very fine pedigree in scientific investigation. And they found that if you did four or five of the following behaviors, you could reduce the risk of getting Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. So they were clumped together by 60%, which is staggering.
It is just staggering.
I mean, if any drug did that, it'd be the most talked about drug on the planet. And so the behaviors that ward off the risk of illness, they don't cure it. They delay it or diminish your chances of getting it, are exercise, and that in the study it was men walking to work and back for at least 2 miles, 5 days a week, I believe, at least, or biking 10 miles a day. The second factor was being of a normal abnormal weight measured by a BMI of 18 to 25. So basically having your weight within a normal range. The third factor was eating fruits and vegetables. I think it was about 4 portions a day of those. Not smoking at all, period, and low to moderate drinking. Now, if you did all of those, there was a 60% reduction of the risk of dementia. Also, a staggering level of reduction of death by any cause and diabetes and stroke and heart disease. So it's not everybody, but we don't have anything else in medicine that I know of that will do a reduction like that.
Pretty impressive. And, you know, your book is also full of lots of personal stories that illustrate different aspects of neuroplastic's way of healing. And many of them involve interventions using a form of energy like light and sound and vibration and electricity and motion. And you have a great personal story in there about using low-level laser treatments to reduce the inflammation of a patient that had a benign brain tumor. That was something I had never heard about.
Okay, well, yeah, this is very, very exciting. So people, when they think of lasers, tend to think of, if they saw Goldfinger, tend to think of James Bond strapped down with a red or purple laser beam coming to cut him in two. Those are hot lasers. And hot lasers destroy flesh, and they are used surgically. But there are also something called low-intensity lasers. They do not burn, and they actually heal flesh. Originally, they were used for wounds that wouldn't normally heal. And there were originally animal experiments where they would, you know, animals would have wounds, and they would use these to heal them. And then they noticed that hair grew. And then they found that, and this is something that is really an important finding, that low-level lasers actually can bring back cartilage and increase the number of chondrocytes which make cartilage. And they also radically reduce chronic inflammation. Now, think of all the diseases that involve chronic inflammation. We're finding, you know, all the autoimmune diseases, arthritis involve chronic inflammation. We're even finding that heart disease, atherosclerosis, vasculitis, they all have aspects of inflammation gone awry. So I describe the work of Dr. Fred Kahn, who's actually here in Toronto. And he was often working with people who had arthritis of the neck. And at one point, for instance, he was working with a man who had arthritis of the neck, but had also had a stroke. And his stroke radically decreased what he could see. It decreased his visual field so that instead of being able to see a wide screen, he could just see a very narrow amount of what was in front of him. And the brain processing area that processes that field of vision is at the back of the head. It's not very far from the neck. Anyway, this man, his name was Alan, had the low-intensity healing lasers put on the back of his neck because he had a sore neck. And he started to notice that he was seeing more widely. And over time, Dr. Kahn started to realize that these lasers could actually have an impact on the brain.
Dr. Norman Doidge, in conversation with Carol Marks. His book is titled The Brain's Way of Healing, Remarkable Discoveries and Recoveries from the Frontiers of Neuroplasticity. It's published by Viking. Carol Marks returns in just a moment in conversation with Dr. Damon Raskin about shingles. That's next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. You may recognize the symptoms of elderly depression, loss of appetite, weight loss, social withdrawal, problems with hygiene, neglecting personal well-being, or even a sadness that lasts over 2 weeks. Sound familiar? Here's what you can do about it. Exercise, eat well, and don't forget to socialize. Researchers at Duke University suggest exercising at least 3 times a week to keep the body and mind healthy. That means swimming, walking, and maybe light exercise classes with the approval of your medical doctor. Another key to happiness is maintaining self-esteem through clubs and groups. You might consider the gardening club or a musical choir. And lastly, treat your body well and it will thank you by feeling well. That means practicing good nutrition and eating well-balanced meals daily. Naturally, the needs of patients vary, but feel free to consult a geriatric specialist to make a personalized treatment plan. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at premiergeriatricrn.com.
When we ran out, we stopped using it.
Why would you stop?
Why undo all the good that's been accomplished? We thought everything was fine, and that was not a good thing.
No.
He started stinking. It was awful.
Shedding comes back. Loss of hair. Lots of dandruff.
Scratching will return. His shedding will increase.
If I ever took Roy off of Dynavite, he would go back to his hair loss.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
When I get down to the bottom of my box of Dynavite,
when I get to about 3/4,
oh no, I've got a couple more scoops.
It's time to place my order.
Dynavite.com.
Each and every day she is getting a Dynavite.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite. If it's working, don't quit.
Don't do what I did and run out.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And here again is the host of the program, Carol Marks, in conversation with Dr. Damon Raskin. He's an internist who will discuss the symptoms and complications of shingles.
For people who don't know, what is shingles? Do we know what causes it? And how many Americans are going to get it during their lifetime? And why are people over 50 most likely to get it?
Okay, so shingles is the reactivation of chickenpox. So anyone who had chickenpox as a child, the virus lays dormant in them and stays in the nerve endings and comes out later in life to haunt you. And we don't always know what the triggers are, why it comes out to haunt you, but it could be, unfortunately, our immune system just sort of weakens as we get older. It could be a stress-related reaction, but it comes out to haunt you, and it comes out along a nerve root, so it could be in your face. It's usually on one side of your abdomen, or it could be really anywhere on one side of the body along a nerve pattern. And as far as how often does it happen, it's extremely common. If you live long enough, probably half of Americans will get shingles by the time they've reached 80. So it's extremely common. And the older we are, the more at risk we are for getting it.
Now, let's talk about the most frequent complications of shingles, and that is the chronic pain syndrome called PHN, which the real name is difficult to pronounce. But when does it occur, and how severe is that pain, and how long can that pain last, you know, that people have?
So, unfortunately, shingles is actually two things. So you get the acute reaction, which is this terribly painful, blistery rash. It's red, it's angry, it forms blisters, and it can be very painful. And then for a lot of people, what happens is the pain, and there's also numbness and burning and tingling along that same area, doesn't actually go away after the rash goes away. And this is what's called PHN, and it stands for post-herpetic neuralgia. And probably about 30% of patients who have shingles will develop post-herpetic neuralgia. And one of the benefits of getting the vaccine, which we can talk about shortly, is that this not only does it markedly reduce your chances of getting shingles in the first place, but if you do get shingles and you've had the vaccine, it also reduces your chances of getting this complication called post-herpetic neuralgia.
Now, in addition to the excruciating pain that can occur after the rash has healed, what are some of the other serious complications of shingles? Do they involve our vision or hearing?
Sure. So it depends where you're getting the shingles. If you get shingles near your eye, which is common because there's a nerve that goes right through there, you can develop impaired vision. If you get shingles along the nerve that gets into the ear, you can develop hearing loss. So there are permanent complications that can develop from shingles. So this is a very, very serious condition, not just a little bit of a rash or a reactivation of chickenpox like some people might think.
Until relatively recently, we thought that shingles was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, but the latest findings show that shingles can reoccur in lots of people. Do we have any idea about the rate?
No, I don't know. There's no statistics to say how often people will redevelop shingles again once they've had it. But we know that it happens, and I see it in my practice all the time, that people will have it two or sometimes even three times, like you said you did. So that's why even if people have had shingles, it's recommended to get the vaccine to prevent further episodes. When it first came out, the vaccine, a few years ago, people said, oh, I already had shingles, I don't need the vaccine. And now what we know is I still want to give people over 50 the vaccine to prevent a recurrence. And that's what I think is, again, very, very important for people to know about.
I couldn't agree with you more. Now, can you tell us a little bit more about the shingles vaccine that Merck has developed? How does it work?
Sure. So basically, there's only one company, as you said, Merck, that makes the vaccine. It's called Zostavax. And again, it's a one-time dose, which is kind of nice. So this gives you, it's a live vaccine, and it gives you immunity so that people who have had chickenpox will not develop shingles. Now, again, it's not 100%. It probably reduces your chances of getting shingles by about half if you get it between the ages of 50 and, say, 65. The longer you wait to get it, the less effective the vaccine is. But nonetheless, I recommend all my patients over the age of 50 who have had chickenpox, or even if they haven't, to go ahead and get the vaccine. And that's what's recommended, too, by the CDC, or Centers for Disease Control.
Now, by the way, does the Medicare Part D program pay for the cost of the shingles vaccine?
Oh, that's a good question. So Medicare will pay. It's difficult for the doctor's office to get reimbursed by Medicare Part D for the vaccine. So for those patients, I actually recommend that you go to a local pharmacy. Most of the big chain pharmacies have the shingles vaccine, and they can actually go ahead and bill your Medicare Part D.
Now, might the patients who receive the vaccine eventually need a booster? Because I guess we're not really sure how long that vaccine is going to be effective.
Right. Because the vaccine is so new, it's only about 6 years old, we don't know. But the recommended right now, guideline is just to get one dose of the vaccine, and there's no evidence that any booster is going to make it more effective. So as long as you get that one dose after you reach the age of 50, we know you get some protection to reduce your chances of getting it, and that is what is currently recommended.
And do you have a final message about why it is so important for people over 50 to get the vaccine from the patients that you've seen in your practice?
Sure. I can tell you that shingles is not just a little rash. It's not just a little annoying. It really, really hurts. And patients are really affected. And the problem is a lot of times people will get pain in certain areas in their chest or in their abdomen before the rash even develops. So they don't even know that this shingle's coming on. And they go to the hospital thinking they're having a heart attack or they're having an appendix problem or something. And then the rash develops. And then they start to just have debilitating pain, and they're not able to work. They're not able to see their family. They're really, really, stuck at home in terrible pain. And then, as we spoke about, this post-herpetic neuralgia happens for so many people. And as you have seen, this can recur on more than one occasion. So if we have a vaccine or we have the technology now to reduce the chances of getting this, please, please speak to your doctor and go ahead and get that vaccine.
Finally, is there any one website or place that you recommend our listeners can find out more about the shingles vaccine?
Sure. So they can go to the Merck website. They could go to Zostavax, which is Z-O-S-T-A-V-A-X. That's the brand name of the vaccine. Or they could also just go to the CDC website, cdc.gov, and they can learn about the vaccine there as well.
That's Dr. Damon Raskin in conversation with Carol Marks. He's an internist. If you'd like more information, visit CDC.gov. That's CDC.gov. I'm Michael Harrison. Coming up next, we're going to be joined by Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine, talk about some of the hot topics being discussed on great talk stations just like the one you're listening to now. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in just a moment. Last week and the week before, I played a track called Everything Passes at this point in the program by a group called Gun Hill Road. They have an album kind of interestingly titled Every 40 Years. This group of fellows in their 60s had not recorded since the early 70s when they had a hit. You may remember it, Back When My Hair Was Short, a couple of albums. They were a hot rock band in their early 20s. Now they're in their mid-60s, and they came back and made an album of 19 tracks called Every 40 Years, and it stands as a testament to the idea that it's never too late to follow your passion and relive your youthful dreams and do it even better the second time around. Here's a song that's very appropriate to today's economy by Gun Hill Road from this new album. It's called Selling Apples.
Just like 1929, when
Isn't that just a great song? Three guys in their 60s, used to be rock stars back in their 20s, came back 40 years later. The album is called Every 40 Years, kind of an interesting title. It's Glenn Leopold, lead singer, he wrote the song, and Steve Goldrich and Paul Reich. They're Gun Hill Road, Every 40 Years, the song Selling Apples. And if you're interested in Gun Hill Road, it's a great album. 19 tracks, all kind of new stuff from old guys, and they're really, really seasoned. Lovely, lovely album. You can get it at GunHillRoadMusic.com. GunHillRoadMusic.com. You're listening to A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and at this point in the program, we're joined by Kevin Casey, who's a senior correspondent on the show, and he's also vice president and executive editor of the trade magazine Talkers, the trade publication in the talk radio business. So we take a little peek behind the curtain of what's going on in the media. And Kevin, let me see if I can approximate my baseball sound.
Almost like badminton, actually.
Yeah, put me in, coach.
About that time.
Baseball. Yeah, baseball is starting. We're coming out of that period of time that talk show hosts who do sports talk radio complain about as being difficult because the only two of the big four sports that they have to talk about are the bottom two, and that's basketball and hockey. Mm-hmm. No disparaging comment meant for basketball or hockey, but let's face it, football and baseball have larger fan bases and are easier for sports talk show hosts to deal with, and they love it when all four are being played as opposed to just two. And baseball has a magnificent history with radio, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. It's, you know, the old saw is that it's a made-for-radio sport, and I think it's, you know, the fact is it's just slow enough and it's easy enough to describe that it's that it has that. It, of course, tied into the tradition of it all.
Baseball is linear. The pitcher has the ball flies through the air, the batter swings at it, it either goes off to a fielder or it goes into the hands of the catcher, whereas football, basketball, and hockey are faster, but they're also multidimensional. They're not as linear. You either follow the puck or you follow the ball, but there are things going on, and you can't see it. And it's really a difficult sport to announce and to follow if you don't really know the sport. So we only have about 30 seconds. Do you think that baseball has a chance with young people, or are they going to have to change the game?
No, I think baseball does fine with young people. I think it'll never have the same kind of emotions and cachet that the NFL does. But, you know, the leagues share fans, and, you know, I think baseball is a very strong sport. I think the two that need to be concerned are obviously basketball and hockey.
Interesting indeed. Kevin, thank you so much. Folks, if you want to check out what's going on behind the scenes in talk radio, go to the website talkers.com. Kevin Casey, senior correspondent and the vice president and executive editor of Talkers, the trade publication in the talk radio business. I'm Michael Harrison. A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here in just a moment.
For Touch of Grey in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. New guidelines from the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism for persons 65 and older reveal that if women drink more than 7 drinks per week or greater than 3 drinks per occasion, and men 14 drinks per week or greater than 4 drinks per occasion, you're at risk for illness or injury. As the body ages, the tolerance to alcoholic beverages decreases. Literally, at 65 and older, you're unable to process alcoholic beverages as, say, a person that is 45. Alcoholic overuse and intolerance can worsen mental confusion, problems with balance and falls, depressive disorders, dehydration, inadequate nutrition, adverse interaction with some medications, and can lead to social isolation. One drink is 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, or 1.5 ounces of liquor, or the amount in a shot glass. Are you ready to acknowledge that at age 65 and older, that fewer than 7 drinks per week or 1 drink per day is the limit and offers you the advantages of leading a healthier and safer lifestyle? I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
When we ran out, we stopped using it.
Why would you stop?
Why undo all the good that's been accomplished? We thought everything was fine, and that was not a good thing.
No.
He started stinking. It was awful.
Shedding comes back, loss of hair, lots of dandruff.
Scratching will return. the shedding will increase.
If I ever took Roy off of Dynavite, he would go back to his hair loss.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
When I get down to the bottom of my box of Dynavite,
when I get to about 3/4.
Oh, no. I've got a couple more scoops.
It's time to place my order. Dynavite.com.
Each and every day she is getting that Dynavite.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite. If it's working, don't quit.
Don't do what I did and run out.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're joined the rest of the way by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman. In conversation now with Steve Brill. Steve Brill's an award-winning journalist, the former owner of Court TV. He's going to talk about his new book, America's Bitter Pill, Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System, published by Random House.
Steven, one of the things I find interesting is and this looks at the Affordable Care Act. I've seen these pieces. I think Jimmy Kimmel even did it. He did a man on the street interview. He took specific pieces of the Affordable Care Act, and he said, actually, to people, you were in favor of the Affordable Care Act, and almost uniformly, oh, yes. And then he asked them, what do you think of Obamacare? Oh, I hate it. What's the story behind that?
Well, Obamacare got a really bad name for two big reasons. One is all the backroom deals and the orgy of lobbying around the passage, which I document that sort of roller coaster saga in the book, but there were all kinds of news stories about little bits and pieces of it as it was being passed, and the whole thing just seemed sort of distasteful. And second, the disastrous launch of the website tainted the whole thing. And one of the great unforced errors of the Obama administration was that from the president on down, they haven't paid as much attention to competent governing as they have to, you know, broad brush policy strokes. And the website was a disaster. And as I explain in the book, there were lots of people in the White House who warned the president that this had to be done differently, that you had to bring in, you know, experts from Silicon Valley and from the outside if you were going to try to pull off the most complicated e-commerce site ever, you know, ever envisioned. So I think those are the two reasons that it's politically tainted, all the lobbying around it and then just the, you know, Keystone Cops-like launch of it.
You know, looking back through the book and seeing, your subtitle says it all, Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. Here you've got a healthcare system that really is in bad shape, yet you've got these competing interests. Was this an impossible task to really get through a comprehensive healthcare bill?
Well, in today's Washington, it is. I mean, what this book... The reason I wanted to write this book was I wanted to write the saga of how a dysfunctional Washington attempts to reform the most dysfunctional industry in America and the largest industry in America. And what you get is what you got, which was what passes as reform is a law that, while the good aspect of it is it provides access to health care to millions of Americans who didn't have it before, which is hugely important.
Yeah.
The bad news is it does it by basically creating, at the government's behest, with the government paying for it, all these new customers who can buy the same products that the rest of us have been buying at ridiculous, exorbitant prices, whether it's $77 for a box of gauze pads in a hospital or $13,700 for a cancer drug, you know, one dose, that would sell for half the price in any other country in the world and cost the drug company maybe, $200 or $300 to make.
Why do other countries do it better? I can't believe that their governments and industries aren't as dysfunctional as ours.
Well, some of them are, some of them aren't. But as I explained in the book, this is all rooted in something that no one paid attention to that happened in 1943. During World War II, there was something called the War Labor Board, and in a meeting that got no press coverage, that board decided that all these employers all around the country, big companies, were suddenly offering health insurance to their workers. That's because they couldn't offer them increases in wages because during World War II, wages were frozen. So they said, well, we'll give you this new thing called health insurance. And the World Labor Board ruled that that didn't constitute a wage increase, and that unleashed a flood of companies offering health insurance. And then the IRS said, well, if it's not a wage, it's also not taxable, so you don't pay tax on it. And that enhanced the flood. And unions started negotiating to have health insurance be in all their union contracts. So the irony is that in the 1940s, when the Roosevelt administration started thinking about doing what other countries were doing at the time, which was supplying, you know, government-supplied health insurance to their people, the unions were against Roosevelt doing it because they wanted to be able to use it to recruit union members. So once we went down that path in the 1940s, the political constituency for government-run health care wasn't there because anyone who had a job at a company of any size was getting health insurance. The people who weren't getting health insurance were people who didn't have jobs or people who had retired, and then President Johnson took care of the people who had retired by getting Medicare through. So while there were tens of millions of Americans without health insurance, they were nowhere near a majority of people, so the political will to do something different wasn't there. And President Obama actually deserves a lot of credit for paying attention to that minority of people and, you know, ramming a reform through Washington in 2009 and 2010.
You mentioned Medicare, and which brings up to my mind, and there's a bias, but to me, one of the great villains in this whole thing is the pharmaceutical industry. We have Medicare, which is prevented by law from doing group negotiations with the pharmaceutical companies. We've got pharmaceutical companies, only two countries on earth allow direct-to-consumer advertising, us and New Zealand. And they just seem to be so strong with the dollars they have that they bend any health care to their needs. Is that overstating it?
Well, no, it's not overstating it, but I guess I would have a different characterization of the villains. I mean, they're doing what they can do to maximize their profits. That's not a surprise.
Right.
The villains are the members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, who do what they want them to do.
Good point.
Who do what the pharmaceutical companies ask them to do. The healthcare industry, the pharmaceutical companies, the so-called not-for-profit hospitals, the medical device makers, they spend, the health insurance, they spend more money on lobbying. They spend four times as much money on lobbying as the next largest beltway player, which is the military-industrial complex, and five times as much as the oil and gas companies. And we think those guys are the big kahunas in Washington. The healthcare industry, you know, makes them, you know, look like a bunch of librarians. So they get their way, and when it came to Obamacare, they got their way by heading off the kind of reforms that would have lowered costs. There's no reform dealing with nonprofit hospital profits. There's no reform dealing with drug industry profits or medical device makers. And that's why we're in the fix we're in.
What did the Affordable Care Act, you mentioned providing insurance for millions of people who are uninsured. What would you say are the positives that managed to get through?
That's the positive. That is the key positive. You can go on an exchange and you can buy health insurance, and 87% of the people who do get a subsidy from the government. And, in fact, the Obama administration was so bad at articulating what it had achieved, or so scared to articulate it because it didn't want to be accused of, God forbid, income redistribution, that something like 40% of the people who have Obamacare and who are getting a subsidy don't even know they're getting a subsidy.
Incredible.
So if you're a middle-class person making, you know, $90,000 a year in a family of four, you might be paying $400 for your health insurance, but the insurance company might be getting $1,000 a month for it. The government's paying the other $600, and you might not even know it. And so the consequence of that is the taxpayers are paying a very high premium, and that's not really the fault of the insurance companies. They actually have very low profit margins. It's the fault of all the parts of the industry that the insurance companies have to, you know, have to pay when you get sick. The hospitals, the drug companies, the people who make wheelchairs, everybody in the business, except for the doctors and nurses, is just making too much money because we don't do the kinds of things in this country that every other country does to control those costs, because we live in the illusion that it's a free market. And I can tell you, as someone who became a patient as I was finishing this book, there is nothing free and workable about this market. When you're a patient, you are not a consumer in the way you're a consumer if you're buying a new smartphone or a new car. You have no information about what you need. You have no information about the quality. You have no information about the cost. And you have no choice of what you're buying unless you're getting, you know, plastic surgery or LASIK or something, which is completely voluntary.
You know, your book brings a lot of light of day to things that the public should know. But frankly, I guess in conclusion, with the lobbying power of the medical establishment, the pharmaceutical industries, the hospitals, is true reform possible?
I'll tell you when it's possible. It's possible when we realize that we have a crisis. Lobbyists typically, in today's Washington, trump the public interest until the public sees a crisis and rises up and then forces their legislators, whether at the state level or the federal level, really to pay attention to them because they really care about something. So that if we, when this gets bad enough, it may end up changing.
That's Steve Brill in conversation with Steve Wiseman. His book is titled America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System, published by Random House. I'm Michael Harrison. Steve Wiseman returns for some final words and information next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. 1 in 3 American senior citizens injures themselves in a fall every year. That means that nearly all of the country's senior population is at risk of a life-changing injury that may result in a loss of independence and a long period of rehabilitation or even death. The most common injuries related to falls are head trauma and hip fractures, according to the Centers for Disease Control. So how can you prevent such an event? Have a home safety evaluation from a licensed physical therapist, routine visits to your medical doctor, exercise 3 times a week for strength and balance training, semi-annual eye exams, and a monthly review of your medications by a doctor or pharmacist. Every time you walk out the door, or even get out of bed in the morning, you run the risk of injuring yourself by a fall. Taking these preventative measures, you do minimize these chances. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
Whoa, a new digital music player. Thanks, Mom.
Oh, I'm glad you like it, because I can't wait to toss the big stereo. And now that we got your dad that big HD TV he wanted, we can throw out our old TV, too.
Hold up. You can't just throw out electronics.
Really?
They need to be recycled or donated.
And how would we do that?
It's so easy, Mom. Today, recycling electronics is just as easy as buying them. GreenerGadgets.org has all the info. We just enter our zip code to find a certified recycling center nearby. There are thousands of them, and new ones are being added all the time. Some of our local stores are even certified recycling locations.
I like that.
Did you know that some of the stuff in our old electronics could be used to make new products and conserve natural resources?
Well, okay then. Let's gather them up. What was that website again?
GreenerGadgets.org. We just enter our zip code and go.
My golden retriever, Sundance, is a lot more playful now. She has more pep
and energy than I've seen in years.
Tons of energy.
Petey is having fun again. He's got a shiny coat and a good healthy weight.
Molly's been having 4 scoops a day. She pushes her little bowl all the way across the room, emptying every last single crumb. She has slimmed down and gotten this puppy look.
She's got life. She's got energy. She's got stuff to give.
We get asked all the time when we're at shows, how do you get your dog so healthy and shiny and glossy?
DinoVite.com.
859-428-1000.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Family will be on Dynavite for the rest of his life.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite. If it's working, don't quit.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DinoVite.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We come to the final segment of this hour of our broadcast and continued conversation and information from Steve Wiseman, Stephen J.J. Wiseman, Esquire. He's an attorney. He is a fabulous writer. He's written a number of books about scams and fraud, and he's there to protect all of us. He certainly is one of the leading experts in America on the subject of scams. He's written Identity Theft Alert. That's his newest book, published by Prentice Hall. He also wrote The Truth About Avoiding Scams, a Prentice Hall book. And the website, scamicide.com, is a must visit if you're interested in protecting yourself from all the scary stuff out there. Steve is here now to talk about email scams. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, when I was thinking about what to talk about today, all I had to do was go to my email account and look in my email box, and I found a number of the same scam phishing email that I'm sure you're getting. We all use email, and when something is popular with everybody, it's also popular with identity thieves. And what they do is they pose as your email provider. And you'll get an email, it follows a similar pattern. It looks like some of them are really awful counterfeits, others are pretty good. But they all indicate there's some kind of emergency that requires your immediate action. Maybe it relates to an unpaid bill, a security problem, an administrative problem. I got one here. Your mailbox has exceeded the storage limit of 1 gigabyte defined by the administrator, blah, 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 blah. You cannot send or receive new messages till you revalidate your mailbox. In any event, it's all the same thing. Their identity thieves are counting on us to react emotionally and immediately and click on the links provided in these emails. Now, if you click on these links, one of two things can happen, and both of them are bad. The first is you may be sent to a website that, again, looks official, asking for information, like your email address, credit card number, password, personal information. This is information they gather to make you a victim of identity theft. It's called phishing. You're lured to a phony website that gets this information from you. But the second thing's even worse, more insidious. By clicking on the link, you unwittingly may be downloading a keystroke logging malware program. This is going to steal all of the information from your computer, including your social security number, your passwords, credit card numbers, banking information, and then the identity thief, once they get this, they're off to the races. One of the things to also remember is, you know, what if you're one of the smart people? And what if you're one of the people who is using good security software? Don't count on it, because the best security software is always at least a month or two behind the latest scams, the latest malware. So what do you do in a situation like this? If you get something like this and you know it's just obviously crap, you don't click on it and you just delete it. But if you think that it might be legitimate, and you do this with anything, you don't click on the link in any email that you get, because you can never be sure if it's legitimate. Go to the real AOL, go to the real Gmail, go to the real Yahoo, and check there if there's an issue. That's the only way you can be secure.
Thank you, Steve Wiseman. And again, if you want to protect yourself against scams and fraud, go to scamicide.com. Steve's latest book is Identity Theft Alert, published by Prentice Hall. And Steve Wiseman is a member of our ensemble. He is a senior correspondent here in A Touch of Gray. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Kevin Casey. Thank you, Beverly Santinello, our producer. Thank you, Carol Marks, host and founder of the program. And thanks to all our affiliates across the country. On behalf of all of us at A Touch of Gray, I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.